Okay, we're beginning here on the top of Kuf Yud Gimel Amud Aleph by the two dots. Amar Rav Chisda, Kovim Zman Sheni V'Chamishi V'Sheni. When it comes to subpoenaing somebody to come to the court or inviting them to a court case, a demand that they appear before the court, we invite them on a Monday, Thursday and Monday, Zimna V'Zimna Bater Zimna. As Rashi notes over here, that we invite them three times. We do not suffice with the fact that we have demanded that they appear before the court once, but we do it a Monday, Thursday, and Monday in order to give them time, if they're not around, if they're busy, to arrange their schedule that they should appear before the court. Ulamachar, and only the day after, which means that we give them the entire day of the third time that we have asked them to come appear before the court, then katvinan, then we write a pticha, then we write a ktav shamta against them, for ignoring the court or for ignoring the court's demand that they appear before the court. Rav Asi ikla be Rav Kahana. So Rav Asi went to the Beit Midrash of Rav Kahana, or the other Girsah is Rav Ashi ikla be Rav Kahana. Chazahai itita, the Azmano the Dina, Bipanya. He demanded that she appear before the court in the afternoon. Ubitzafron, the next day, Kativalapticha. He right away wrote a shtar, saying that she had ignored the court, that it was a chutzpah that she didn't appear, and therefore she was in shamta. Amalei lo savar lamar the hadam Rav Chisda. Why aren't you worried about what Rav Chisda said before, that we give them a Monday, Thursday, Monday? I mean, you have to give a person ample time to respond to the court order. Why over here by the woman are you demanding after one invitation to appear before the court, and she does not appear, you're penalizing her right away? Why don't you give her the same amount of time that Rav Chisda mentioned before, which is Kovim Zman Sheni V'Chamishi V'Sheni. We give them a Monday, Thursday, Monday. Amalei, Hani Milei Gavro De'Anis. That's only true for a man who is under duress or is involved in other work matters, Velete B'Mato, and therefore he might be traveling outside of the city. He might not be here. Aval Itita, but with the woman, Kevin De'Ita B'Mato, since she is always in the city, Lo Atio, Velo atyo, and she doesn't appear before the court, moredeti, then she's definitely someone who is rejecting the jurisdiction of the Beit Din, and therefore we could write a ktav ticha right away. So what is being said here is that this is not an objective standard where we say, oh, Monday, Thursday, Monday, and that's it. It has to do with the nature of the schedules of the individuals, as well as what is the norms of society in that time. And those norms will dictate when an invitation from Beit Din or a demand to appear before court is considered to be chutzpah or a rejection of the jurisdiction of the court versus simply the inability of the person to appear before the court because of circumstances or because of what they are involved in. And therefore, we have to give ample time to those individuals who might otherwise be preoccupied versus individuals who could appear immediately and they don't appear, that's already considered to be a problem. But the basic idea is that when the court asks you to appear, you must respond to the court. You cannot ignore the court. You cannot ignore their jurisdiction. And if you do ignore it, then the court has the right to penalize you with a ktav ticha, with a ktav that says that you're in shamta for violating the jurisdiction of the court. Amar Rav Yehuda, lo yivnan zimna, lo biyomi nisan, velo biyomi detishrei. We do not make invitations or set court dates for people to appear, not in the springtime, meaning during the month of Nisan, below biyomei de Tishrei, and not in the fall time during the month of Tishrei. Rashi over here says the reason being because those are the Zman Katsir Ubatsir. Those are the times of the harvest. Those are the times when the people are bringing in the fruits from the fields or the time when they are planting. Meaning when the people are involved or deeply involved in their work, it would be inappropriate at that time to invite someone to a court case. For instance, an accountant who was putting together the taxes. So around the tax filing dates, it would be inappropriate to invite them to a court date because it's clear that during that time, they're busy with whatever work it is. And the same would be true today. If the harvest or the planting seasons were different, then those would dictate as to when we should not invite people to come to the court, because it would interfere with their livelihood. On the other hand, if you look in the Rambam and others, they say the reason that we do not make these invitations during Nisan and Tishrei has nothing to do with people's work schedules, but rather to do with the Chagim, with the holidays that are found there and the mitzvot that people are involved with. We do not want to invite people to court cases during these periods of time when they are asukim, when they're involved in the mitzvot of these time periods, which are all-encompassing and require a tremendous amount of effort and expenditure by people, and therefore we don't want to interfere with that. So it's an inappropriate time to assign a court case during the middle of the Yamim Noraim, in the middle of Sukkot, or during the time period before or a little bit after Pesach. Velo b'malei Yom HaTova, and not an Erev Yom Tov. Velo b'malei Shabto, and not an Erev Shabbat. Those are self-evident because there are already pressures to prepare for Yom Tov or Shabbat, and therefore it would be inappropriate to sign a court date on that day and interfere with people's ability to prepare for the Shabbat or the Yom Tov. Aval, minisan, the batayo minisan, during Nisan you can serve notice to the individual that they must appear in court after Nisan, ubiyom tishrei, the bata tishrei kavinan. Or, again, in Tishrei you can serve them notice that they have a court date that's afterwards. So the problem is not the serving of notice, it's simply the appearance in the court. So we can demand that they appear in court later, where it won't interfere with whatever's going on in Nisan and Tishrei, depending on how you interpret the Gemara beforehand. So therefore, serving notice is fine because you're only telling them that they have to appear much later and it won't interfere with what they're doing now. But to ask them to appear in court during that period of time would be considered inappropriate. Mimale Shabto, the Bater Mimale Shabto, Lo Kavina. On Erev Shabbat, we do not serve notice to an individual to come after Shabbat or on a different day. My Taima, but Vidite the Shabto Torid. Person is too engrossed in the preparations for Shabbat, and therefore, even to serve notice would be too difficult on the individual, distracting to the individual, or the individual won't be able to pay heed or notice to it because of the fact that they're so engrossed in their preparations for Shabbat. So where there is duress or pressure, then we don't say simply that you can't have a court date on that day, but you also can't serve notice because the person can't properly pay attention to it, can't properly deal with what you are giving them. Or if they do that, then they're going to stop doing what they're supposed to be engrossed in and whatever they're supposed to be involved in. So when it comes to Erev Shabbat, that time period is both not good for setting court dates as well as serving notice. Whereas with regards to Nisan and Tishrei, even though we won't set court dates then, there are periods in time where people can focus or they can understand that if you serve them notice, that they can deal with the court dates at a much later time. Amar Rav Nachman, lo yavinan zimna, lo lebnei kala bikala, lo bnei rigla berigla. We do not give people court dates, not for those that are appearing for the kala, which was the gathering to hear the drusha on Shabbat. So we don't say when he comes to that gathering, when he appears for the shir on Shabbat, we don't say to him, oh listen, you have a court date on Monday. Because as Rashi says over here, Dimimna v'loati l'kala, because then people are going to stop coming to the kala. And the same thing with Bnei HaRegel. The Bnei HaRegel who come up to hear the halochot of the regel before the chag, or they gather together for the drusha of Shabbat HaGadol, Shabbat Shuvah, then we don't serve them notice during that period of time. Because then you're going to cause people to desist from appearing at these occasions because they're afraid that the courts are going to come after them or they're going to serve them notice. So we want to separate between people's religious practice, between their ability to learn Torah and to join the rest of the community and the issues of the court. And for the court to usurp that or utilize these religious moments where people are coming to learn Torah to benefit themselves, to benefit the parties as an opportune moment to serve notice to individuals, we consider that inappropriate because, as Rashi says here, people will desist from coming. Other Rishonim note the problems of the fact that there will be bittul Torah because either if they're serving them notice, then the people will be upset or distracted by that matter. Or others still suggest that it talks about setting the dates during these periods of time where it will take people away from what otherwise they're supposed to be doing during these periods of time. So it would be inappropriate to serve notice to people when they're coming for these particular events. When they used to come before Rav Nachman, he would say, are they gathering here for your benefit? Meaning Rav Nachman would say to those people that were claimants and trying to get the defendants to come and asking the Rav Nachman or the courts to issue or serve notice to these individuals, he says they're not coming here for that purpose. That's not what the gathering is for. The gathering is not to benefit you. It's not an event where the court should exercise its jurisdiction, because that's not the purpose of the event, and that's not the reason that people are showing up here. And therefore, it's a misuse or capitalizing on a religious event to benefit yourselves, and that would be inappropriate. Vayitna dikaramai chashinan. And today, where we have people who are thieves, cheaters, deceivers, then we worry about that, meaning that since we don't have opportunities to catch up with these individuals, and therefore the only opportunity to catch these individuals is during these events or during these religious practices, then we do worry about the fact that if we don't serve them notice now, there'll be no chance to catch up with them at other times. So if people are escaping the law and trying to avoid being served notice, but they want to participate in the general religious practices of the community, then that kind of behavior warrants that we take action when they come up for the religious practice, because it's clear here that they want to be a part of the community without having to have the responsibilities of being a part of that community and acting appropriately in other situations. And therefore, just like they are capitalizing on the event to join the community, we will capitalize on their being there or being present to serve them notice so that they don't escape from the hands of justice. But that would then apply, and again, in cases where someone comes to the Beit Knesset, to the Beit Midrash, to learn or to daven, then if the person is otherwise found outside of these locations and easily reachable, then it would be inappropriate, again, to serve them notice in those particular locations, since they're not running away. It's not like they're trying to avoid the law, and therefore we wouldn't serve them notice in those locations. But if that's the only place that they're found, and otherwise they are unreachable or impossible to catch up with, then we would serve them notice in those locations, despite the fact that we are uncomfortable with doing so. The last line in the Mishnah says that if it is something that has achrayut, meaning it's real property, then the children are obligated to return the object to the gazlan. Matne la Rabbi, the Rabbi Shimon Barei. We already saw this on the previous dapim, that Rabbi taught his son Rabbi Shimon lo davar sheyesh b'achrayut mamash. When the Mishnah says that it means real property, it doesn't mean literally real property, real estate. Elo afilu para v'choresh ba, but even a cow that he's playing with, chamor u'michamer acharav, or a donkey that he is driving, chayavin lehachzir, they must return it, mipnei kvod avihen, because of the honor of their father, because these objects are obviously the stolen objects, and people clearly or easily identify them as being objects of theft, and therefore it would be inappropriate for them to hold on to them, and they should return those items to their rightful owner in order to remove the gezel from their hands, as well as for the kvod of their father, that it be returned, and they rectify that situation. And we saw earlier in the Masechta, obviously it's in a case where it mattered to their father, and their father had done tshuva, and therefore there's a reason to worry about kvod avihen. Baimine Rav Kahana meirav. Rav Kahana queried of Rav, mita umeseva leha. If it is a couch that he rested upon, that was the way that they ate in their day. They used to lean on the couch, and they used to eat in that manner. Shulchan vochelala, a table that he's eating with. Mahu, what is the din with that? Are these discrete items that clearly have the shame gezel upon them, and therefore they have to be returned? Or do we say since they're used in the privacy of one's home, they are not public displays of the gezel, and therefore there's no problem of kvod avihen? Amar lo, so Rav responded to him, ten chacham v'yech kamod, that the phrase from the pasuk in Mishlei is applicable to you, that if you give something to the wise, they make more wisdom out of it. And the way that Rashi reads the conclusion of the Gemara over here is that by mita and shulchan, they have the same din as a para and a chamor. And since these are discrete objects that clearly are associated with the gezel, and people come in and out of the house, even though it's not in public view, but people do visit the house and people do see it, then it would also be appropriate to return those items, just like it is by the para and the chamor. Okay, now we move on to the next Mishnah. The Mishnah says, in portin, one may not ask for change, lo mitevat hamochsim, velo mikis shel gabayin. You should not ask for change here, not change in the sense that you're paying them and asking for change back, but in essence to break the coin into smaller component parts, or to break the bill today into smaller component parts. You shouldn't ask for change, not from the tevat of the mochsim, not from the box of the customs collectors, below mikis shel gabayin, and not from the wallet or the pouch of the tax collectors. Ve'ein notli mehen tzedaka, and you also do not take from them tzedaka out of these boxes, out of these collection mechanisms. You don't take tzedaka. The reason Rashi suggests over here is because we assume that all of this is shehein shel gezel, that this money that is in their possession came about through theft. We'll explain why in the Gemara we're worried about the customs collectors and the tax collectors. The money that they have collected is really money of theft and not what they deserve based on the laws of the land. So number one, we don't want you changing money there. Tosafot already discusses whether this is mi'ikar adin, because we believe, like the Rabbanan, that Stam Zela does not have Yeush Balim. And therefore, the lack of Yeush Balim means that the money in the hands of the Mokhes or the Gabai is really still the money of theft, and it hasn't gone through Yeush and Shinui Rishut. And therefore, Mi'ikar Adin, it's still classified as Gezel. Or, even according to Rabbi Shimon, who says that Stam Zela is, or does have Yeush Balim, nevertheless, we still would not want you to do this, even though now there's Yeush and Shinui Rishut, which would take away the shame Gezel from the item. And therefore, you as a counterparty to this individual should not have to worry about it, because you're not dealing directly with the object of Gezel. Nevertheless, that's what says, Mishum de Davar Migunehu. It is something that is inappropriate, or something that is considered to be Machzik Yidei Ovrei Avera. Someone is helping out or strengthening the hand of the Ovrei Avera, because these people clearly are involved in theft and dealing with items of theft, and that you're willing to transact with them afterwards or to change money with them, it's as if it makes what they're doing okay. And for that same reason, Eit Non Limahem Tzedaka, whether it's, again, like Rashi says, Mishum Gezel Mi'ikar Adin, like Tosafot suggests that there's no Yeush over here, and therefore, their giving of tzedakah is giving stolen money to tzedakah, which we do not want to accept. Or whether because it's a davar migune, even though we've cleared the actual gzela from the money itself, nevertheless, to take the money from these individuals would be inappropriate. And there are rishonim that even go as far as to say the problem that we have today, which is, this is a type of whitewashing justification or laundering of these stolen goods. Because these individuals think that if they give tzedakah, if they do charity with it, it justifies the behaviors that they've had until now, or somehow justifies that the theft is okay because they're doing charity with that theft. The Rambam in the Perush HaMishnayot has a slightly different explanation than everyone else, which is that when it speaks about here the Moksim and the Gabai, the Rambam brings over here, Uchmo Kein, Ein Portim Mimash Lifnei Gabai Tzedakah. That the gabai that we're speaking about over here is not a gabai of the misim, of the taxes, but rather a gabai of tzedakah. And it would be inappropriate to change money in the tzedakah box, mishum chashad, because of people suspecting, shaliach shduoto, shum nechzei tzedakah. So people should not think that he's taking money out of the tzedakah box, meaning that he didn't put in the coin, or they didn't see him put in the coin, and now he's just taking money out of the tzedakah box and stealing for it. Or that the Gabai Tzedakah is somehow using this or utilizing this to his own benefit or to discharge his obligations. And therefore, it's inappropriate to do, quote unquote, business with the Gabai Tzedakah because of the fact that it looks from the outside as if someone is taking or utilizing or personally absconding with the monies of Tzedakah. And that does have some nafkamino to halacha, which is that when generally one goes in to change money inside of the tzedakah box, it's appropriate that one gives some of that money to tzedakah. Not that they simply give in a dollar and get back four quarters, or give in a shekel and get back two half shekelim, but they should actually give some of that money to the tzedakah so that the tzedakah benefits from the situation. You're not simply utilizing it. And it might be even appropriate to take the money out first from the tzedakah box and then put in the money that you're changing, because then it's clear to people that you're putting back in money and not taking from the tzedakah box, rather than putting it first and then trying to take the change out afterwards, because then people who miss the first part of the transaction will look like a person is taking from the tzedakah box without giving in. Aval, notel hu mitoch beito o min hashuk. On the other hand, if the individual is in his home, or he is in the shuk, these individuals, then you're allowed to take money from them, because not everything that they have is theft. And since there's some distance from his quote-unquote collection box or his pouch, then we assume that these monies are monies that are not necessarily from theft, or that it's not davar migunet, as Tosfot says, even though it may not have the shame gezel on it, but now that's not taken directly from that which is stolen, then it looks better, or the appearances seem to be much more neutral in that case, and therefore we can't accept for money from them in those instances, change money with them, or accept tzedakah from them, because they're not paying it directly out of the stolen goods. Tano. Now we do have a qualification of our Mishnah, which is aval noten lo dinar, venoten lo et hashar. That if an individual owes money to the customs collectors or to the tax collector, and then they give them a dinar, a larger coin, because they don't have change, then they are allowed to accept change back. As Rashi says, it's kematzil miyadam, because you're basically saving your own money. If you don't accept the change back, then you're just allowing him to steal more, and you are the one or the loser in that case. So we do allow you to accept change in that case from the mokhes or the gabai, because they're either, if we're doing this lifnim mishurta din, the chachamim didn't uphold their requirement that you don't accept these monies from them because it would end up generating a loss for you, or if mi'ikar adin, they might be a problem of their money being gezel, that when you give in the dinar, then just allowing him to keep your dinar is also going to just generate more gezel and not help out the situation. So your acceptance of the change is not taking an object of gezel, it's getting back what belongs to you, and that we do allow you to do. Umochsin. And we say here that one should not accept the monies from the Tevata Mochsim and the Kishel Gabaim. Now we have a question that's going to surround the rest of today's daf, which is V'Amar Shmuel. Doesn't Shmuel say, Dina demachuta dina? The law of the land governs. And if the law of the land is to collect these items, these customs, or these taxes, why is it then appropriate to consider these individuals as thieves? Or, we're going to see later in today's daf, why is it then okay to try to escape from paying these individuals or to avoid paying these individuals if it's really an issue of dina demachuta dina? Now, just in taking a step back, as to the logic or the thesis behind why dina machuta dina, there are two main approaches in the Rishonim as to why dina machuta dina. One approach in the Rishonim, which is found in the likes of the Rosh, the Ran, is that the land is owned by the king. There's this sort of eminent domain that exists there in terms of the king's ownership or the government's ownership over the land, and therefore they can make a determination as to what the rules are in order for you to live on the land. In essence, you are a renter, you are a borrower who is on the land, and if you want to live on this land, you want to join this community, then you have to follow the rules that are associated with that. And since the king owns those properties, he can make demands or rules about how one lives on this land, or what the requirements are to live in his kingdom. The other way to formulate it is, this is brought by the Rashbam, the Rambam, and others, is that basically it is a social contract that the individuals who live in this kingdom or under this jurisdiction have agreed that this is the set of laws or the rules by which one who wants to live in this community, in this area, must abide by these rules in order to be a member of this society. So that the rules derive from this social contract. Now, there is a nafkamina between these two different reasons. We'll list a couple of those differences. One difference comes up from a huge chiddush of the Ran in Masechet Nedarim, who says that dina demachuta dina only applies to lands outside of Eretz Yisrael, but not to the Jewish kings in Eretz Yisrael. And the difference that he notes is because this idea of eminent domain or ownership of property is only true in Chutz La'aretz, outside of Eretz Yisrael. But in Eretz Yisrael itself, where every Jew has his Dalet Amot, and he owns the land and he's entitled to a Yerusha in the land of Israel, the king doesn't have that right to push him out or to exercise that eminent domain. And for that reason, there is no Dina de Machuta Dina inside of Eretz Yisrael. It's actually not a distinction necessarily between a Jewish and a non-Jewish king, but rather between Eretz Yisrael and Chutz La'aretz. It's a big Chiddush of the Ran, but it really relies on the idea of Dina Machuta Dina being connected to the land. The other nafkamina that would come out from this is, what is the jurisdiction of the king or the government based on Dina de Machuta Dina? If you say that it is associated with the land ownership, it might be that the laws or the demands that the king may be placed on the individuals has to be surrounding the ownership or the living on the land, but not items that have nothing to do with the dwelling on the land or the use of the land, because all of his power or rights to power derive from the land, and that's where he can make demands for payment of taxes and other rules, but outside of that, maybe he has no jurisdiction. Whereas if you believe that it is a social contract, in both of those cases, whether it's in Eretz Yisrael or Chutz La'aretz, it should make no difference. And also, what the jurisdiction would not be limited if you think that it's a social contract, that they should be able to tax no matter what tax or set laws, no matter what the issue is, even if it's disassociated from the land. The Ramban also has an interesting qualification of Dina de Malchut Dina, and he says it comes out of the wording of the way that the Gemara expresses it, is that it's not Dina de Malka Dina. It does not mean that the king can do as he pleases, but rather Dina de Malchut Dina, that it is the rules of the land or of the country. And therefore, the Ramban believes that the Dina de Machuta Dina only applies to certain customs or areas of jurisdiction where kings for time immemorial exercise power or are given the rights to deal with it. But if a king comes up with some newfangled idea or rule, that does not necessarily mean that it's subsumed under Dina de Machuta Dina, because that's the Dina of the Malka, that's the Dina of the king. So that's one thing that the Ramban says, that this has to have some sort of precedent in the law in order for the king to exercise those rights. The other thing which interestingly comes out, partly from the Ramban there and partly from the way that the Rashbam explains it, is that there can't be any bias in the law, which is that you can't apply the law to some parties within the country. For instance, you are only charging the tax to the Jewish members of the country, or it only applies to certain trades. I mean, that it has to be something which is equal under the law and affects all people equally. And so therefore, Dina de Machuta Dina will only apply if it's a fair rule, not if the rule involves some sort of bias or intentional persecution of a particular group of individuals or set of occupations. And so some of the Rishonim believe that Dina de Malchuta Dina has to be applied equally. Again, not all Rishonim agree to those latter qualifications. Some believe that there is a right of the king to set different rules for different peoples, different rules for different occupations, as long as what they're doing makes some sort of sense, or again, is applied equally once it's determined that the law is put into place. It is not something that is enforced randomly or only apply to certain individuals and not to the entire class of individuals that are affected by the law. There are also those like the Shach that make it clear that when it comes to Dina de Machuta Dina, that that's only true if it does not go against the laws of the Torah. The Dina de Machuta Dina, even if you say it's Doraita, it's a Torah law, that does not mean that it overrides other Torah laws. And if there's a conflict between Torah law and Dina de Machuta Dina, then the Torah law would trump in that instance. So now, once we have that in place, or that assumption of Dina de Machuta Dina, The question is here, you have customs collectors or tax collectors that are acting on behalf of the king or who are acting on behalf of the government. So then why should the items that are in their hand, the money that they collected, be considered to be gezel if they are empowered by the governing authorities to do this? So now the Gemara answers, Amar Rav Chanina Bar Kahana Amar Shmuel, B'machis Shein Lo Kitzvah. It's a tax collector that has no limit. The Bei Rabbi Yane Amar B'machis HaOmeid Me'elav. It's a self-appointed tax collector. So both of these are problematic because obviously the self-appointed tax collector is not coming under the auspices of the government and therefore is not under the rubric of Dina de Malchut Dina. And that's why it's considered to be gezel. The moches she'en lo kitzvah, the one who has no limit, there is a problem because then there's unfair taxation or it's applied in an unequal manner to the different individuals to live under the jurisdiction of this individual. In their day, generally, the way that the customs worked or the tax collection worked was that you bought that right from the king. You paid a fixed sum to the king. And the way that you made money, and people made this into a very profitable business, is obviously that you charged more than you had to pay the king in order to gain that right of taxation or to collect customs in that area. Now, that would only work if the person who bought the right then, first of all, equally applies it to all the people under his jurisdiction. It's not random how he applies the taxation or the customs. And number two is that there's some limit to what he collects. If there is an unlimited amount, then it starts to become theft because that's not in a reasonable exercising of that right that the king gave to him. The king gives him a right to make some profit or to make some money on it. He doesn't give him endless rights to just take and take and take from people. And therefore, that's why it's deemed or considered to be theft because that individual is not working under the rubric of Dina de Malchut Dina. So both of those cases, then, that's why we consider it to be gezel, or that's the problem that is being noted in our Mishnah. Ika de matni laha, there are some who state these answers as to why there is not a problem of dina de machuta dina with regards to another Mishnah, which is lo yubash adam kilayim, afilu agabei asara bigadim laviach bo atameches. A person should not put on kilayim because it's asur to wear kilayim. Even if he's putting it on top of another 10 pieces of clothing, whereby he's not really benefiting from this piece of the clothing, but he's only doing it in order to escape the taxation, which is you're only taxed on items that you're not wearing. If it's your own clothing, you're not taxed on it. But if it's clothing that you are selling, you would be taxed on it. So in order to avoid the taxation, he puts on or wears all of this clothing. So one is not permitted to do that with a beged kilayim. Matznita and the local Rabbi Akiva. That Mishnah is not like the opinion of Rabbi Kiva. Titanio, because we have a braita, asur lavriach et ameches. One is not permitted to escape from paying taxation. If you look down in the Hagot Mironchenberg, he says that the girsa really is not that you can't escape from paying taxation, but you may not wear the kilayim in order to escape taxation. Bishimon Omer Bishimon Yakiva, mutar lavriach et ameches. You are allowed again, to wear this kilayim, or to do this in order to escape from the taxation. Bishlama the inyan kilayim b'hakamithlege. We understand regards to kilayim, whether one is permitted to wear the kilayim or not permitted to wear the kilayim, that revolves around the halachic issue of davar she'enu mitkavein, an unintentional violation of a mitzvah. The mar savar davar she'enu mitkavein mutar. This is a machloke between Rabbi Shimon and Rabbi Yehuda that has application, especially with regards to Melachot of Shabbat, but everywhere in the Torah, which is, if you have an unintentional violation of a mitzvah, is that considered to be mutar? Over here, where he's wearing the kilayim, and he's not intending to wear the kilayim, he's only putting the kilayim on in order to avoid the taxation, so he's not being mitkavein, he's not intending to wear it, and since, again, he's wearing it in a manner where he's getting no benefit from it, and he's not wearing it like a piece of clothing, that would be considered wearing, therefore it would be mutar. Umar savar, davashayin mitkavein asur. Even if his intention is to not wear the kilayim, but simply to avoid the taxation, that's not enough a reason to make it mutar. It's still asur, at least midrabanan, maybe even deoraita, according to the one who says davashayin mitkavein is asur. So we can explain the machlok between Rabbi Kiva and the Chachamim, with regards to whether you're permitted to do this with kinayim or not. From a halachic standpoint, that has to do with dorashen mitzkavein. El avriach bota meches, independent of that, even if you're permitted to do it halachically, why are you allowed to avoid the taxation? Mishari, since when is it mutar to escape or evade taxes? Vamar Shmuel, dina de machuta dina. The same question that we asked with regards to our Mishnah, you can ask it with regards to that Mishnah in Kilayim as well. Why is it permitted for one to escape paying taxes? Samar Chanina Bar Kahana, Amar Shmuel, de machuis she'en lo kitzva. The same answer that we gave here, it's a customs collector, a tax collector that has no limit to his collection. That it's a self-appointed tax collector, so they're not subsumed under this din of dina de machuta dina. And there's some that say this statement about these unauthorized individuals with regards to this Mishnah, which is the Mishnah that Darim says, Nodrim laharagim ulacharamim ulamuchsim shehi shel truma shehi shel beit ha-melech afopi she'eno shel truma afopi she'eno shel ha-melech. So one is permitted to take a neder, whether it's to these haragim, which are these marauders or killers that come around and extort money from people, or from the charamim, Rashi calls them belligerent, bellicose, quarrelsome individuals who go around stealing people's money or making up issues and then taking their money. Others say that these charamim are government-appointed officials to enforce certain restrictions or certain laws, or the mochsim, or the customs or tax collectors, that they can take a neder to the effect, shehi shel truma, and declare the items to be truma, which would exempt them from the taxation, shehi shel beit ha-melech, or it belongs to the king. So these people don't want to get involved in altercations with the king if they take the king's stuff, so they're going to leave it behind. So the nature of the neder, and we've spoken about this numerous times, this idea that these individuals, even though they're thieves, marauders, and killers, that they still respect when it comes to ben adam lemakom, when it comes to issues of truma, of kodoshim, or it comes to the king, where it's going to be too difficult for them to deal with it, there they're willing to walk away. So even though they don't care about ben adam lechavero, when it comes to ben adam lemakom, they were chared al dvar Hashem, and if they said it was truma, or if they said it belonged to the Beit HaMelech, the person would then walk away. And again, given the nature of a shvua or a neder in that day, the seriousness by which people took it or understood it, they, when someone took a neder and said that's the case, they accepted the neder. Now what the person does, as the Baal HaTosafot say over there, umechashev belibo, the person in their heart, when they take the neder, say it only applies for today, oh, I don't really mean this. And even though generally we say dvarim sholev enam dvarim, things that are in a person's heart are not meaningful, over here, we would, because of the circumstances and the situation where the person's under duress, we do allow them to account for the dvarim shebelev, and therefore the tnai or the condition that they make in the heart at the time is acceptable to unwind or to bring a petach to that neder. Tosafot says, matovu manaim, if you whisper under your breath the tnai, for sure then that would take effect, that condition. Because the whole purpose of the neder over here is not to engage or to have the neder come true. It's simply a way to get rid of these people who are unlawfully taking your possessions. And so the Gemara asks again about that Mishnah, Ola Mochsim, why are you allowed to avoid paying customs or taxes? Bar Shmuel, Dina de Machuta, Dina. Once again here, we have the problem that if it's a lawful collection of taxes, why are you allowed to avoid those taxes? So, Amar Rabbi Chanina Bar Kehana, Amar Shmuel, B'moche Shein Lo Kitzva, the same answer we've given before, which is it's a tax collector without any limits. Debei Rabbi Yane, Amar B'moche Somed Me'elav, it's a customs or tax collector that is self-appointed. And now we have an additional answer, which is Ravashi Amar B'moche Knani. We're talking about a tax collector from the Knani. Rashi over here, because of the subsequent Gemara, adds in the additional word, Moche Shu Knani Anas, which is that he is not a rightful tax collector, but rather he is someone who is a strong arm or a strong man here. But then it introduces a new element to the sugya over here, which harks back to what we saw in the Mishnah Yod back earlier in the Masechta in Baba Kama, which is, as Rashi notes over here, Heicha Delekel Chilul Hashem, if there's no Chilul Hashem in the matter, She'ein mevin shezeh mechasev, that this person, the tax collector, doesn't realize that the individual is lying, then in that case, you are allowed to avoid the taxation because it's not necessarily inappropriate to steal from the Kanani. That we'll have to expand upon in a minute. And therefore, Rashi explains the cases before of Dina de Machuta Dina dealing with the Mocheis Yisrael, that these collectors were Jewish collectors who had bought the right from the king. And if they're coming and they had bought the right from the king, they're rightfully taken from you. And you're not allowed to cheat him out of the taxes or the customs that he has purchased or has the right to collect. And that's the distinction or the contrast between the Mochsim that we were speaking about before and this Mocheis, is whether he is a Jewish collector or a non-Jewish collector. That obviously opens up Pandora's box as to why should there be such a difference. D'tanya, because there is a bright day, Yisrael v'Kanani Anas, Shibau l'din, if you have Yisrael. And in Kanani, once again here, it's modified by the word Anas, which probably pushed Rashi the same thing with regards to what Rav Ashi said before, which is that this is not a person who is a friendly, normal citizen, but this is an individual who presses other people for money, probably improperly. If you're able to exonerate the Israel under the Jewish law, then do that. That's the way that we adjudicate these cases. If you can, through the laws of the land, zakeu, you should then exonerate the Jew through that way. This is the way that you adjudicate the cases. In love, if that's not the case, then you try some backhanded method, some way to get around this individual to escape from having to pay him. Divrei Rabbi Shmuel. Rabbi Kiva Omer, ein bayin alav ba'akifin mibnei kiddush Hashem. That we don't allow you to do these subverted methods in order to escape from having to pay him because of the problem of kiddush Hashem, or the opposite, which is a chilul Hashem. Rabbi Kiva, time of the ika kiddush Hashem. It's only because there's a kiddush Hashem for a person to act in an honest, straightforward manner. How like a kiddush Hashem, had it not been for the kiddush Hashem or the possible chilul Hashem that be created, bayin, we would be bayin alav ve'akifin, ve'gezel knani mishari, since when is it mutar to steal from a knani? Which the Gemara then will continue on and qualify the statement as to when it is or is not mutar for a person to act in this manner. Once again here, the Shitu Mekubetzet appears on the daf and quotes the Meiri, similar to the way that the Meiri explains the Gemara back in the earlier in the Masechta by Shor Yisrael Shenagach Shor Knani or Shor Knani Shenagach Shor Yisrael. He says a similar thing over here, that this whole idea here that you're allowed to, quote unquote, try to exonerate the Israel and Din no matter which way you adjudicate the case, or Banin Allah Ba'akifin, all of these permissions that seem to be appearing in the Gemara, he limits or qualifies that and says, "Bezeh dafka b'knanim ovdei lilim anasim." We're talking about these knanim who are ovdei avodah zarah, who are marauders or people who take things by force. She'enan gedurim b'derchei adatot, that they don't have civility or civil laws or basic laws that are associated with them. Aval botona gedurim b'derchei adatot. But if you live in a land that has proper laws and civility, lo ne'amarkein, this is not true. If they come to us to adjudicate a case, we go straight down the path, we go by the letter of the law, and we give them the right outcome or the right adjudication in that case, because these aren't people who are trying to cheat, or some people who are trying to do things in a manner that is inappropriate. And since they're acting within the basic civility and normative laws of the nation, then we have to treat them the same way, and that there is a law of the land, and it is appropriate to adjudicate the case, and not just try to exonerate the Israel in that case. You have to actually come to the bottom line or the proper outcome in the case. So once again, here you see the Shita Mekubetzet trying to limit the application of what the Gemara is speaking about here to a specific time or a specific type of society, type of society which does not have basic civil laws that are associated with it. Now, what's interesting about Rav Ashi's statement is that the Gemara already here brought three examples of cases where we would apply Dina de Machuta Dina. In each of those cases, we gave the same answers, that these individuals are not coming under the auspices of the government. Only here at the end do we have the introduction of Rav Ashi's statement that we also have an opportunity by Moches Knani. The question is, why does Rav Ashi only appear here at the end and does not appear in the other cases? The Chedushei Rashbo here on the daf says that the reason that it's brought only here is because Elanira Devadei Dehadar Rav Ashi Lukai Elahadi Kikilayim, that this din of Rav Ashi only applies to the case of Kilayim. And he says that there were Sfarim, Mugim, that brought the case of Kilayim at the end. And then Rav Ashi's statement will only be referencing to that case of Kilayim. And there was a case of what we'll call Hafkat Halvato, which we'll see later on in the Gemara, might be permitted in the case of one escaping from an obligation by means that are considered to be, quote-unquote, appropriate, even though they are not to the letter of the law. Now the Gemara continues and says, V'gezel Knani Mishari, since when is theft from a Knani permitted? V'atan, you don't have a bright tamar b'shimon, davar zed darash Rabbi Akiva k'sheba mizfirin. This is what Rabbi Akiva was doresh from Akim Sefirin, minar v'gezel Knani shu asur. How do you know that theft from a Knani is not permitted? Tamalomar, achrei nimkar, ge'ula t'yelo. This is the parshiyah at the end of Sefer Vayikra, speaking about an Eved Ivri. The Eved Ivri, who is sold, whether he's sold to another Jew, or then possibly sold to a Knani, it says at the end of his time, Ge'ula Tielo, you have the ability to redeem him. Shalo yimashkenu v'yetze, that you can't go ahead and have Beit Din declare him free and just release him from this Knani. You can't just say, go free because you're a Knani, and therefore you don't have an entitlement to him. But rather, you have to, Ge'ula Tielo, you have to pay him the appropriate amount in order to release this Eved Ivri, who is now under the auspices of an Eved Knani. Yachol yiglom alav. You would think that maybe he could. The way Rashi views this is, Yaniach et haKnani lichpo ulhosif litvo mashalo natan. That maybe you will let the Knani then demand more money than is deserved in order to free this Eved Ivri. So Rashi views this as being two sides. You cannot underpay the Knani in order to release the Eved Ivri, but the Eved Knani also can't gouge on pricing and ask for this exorbitant price, which isn't the fair value of what he purchased the Eved Ivri for, in order to let him go free. And so there's a balance between both of them. Tamalomar v'chishav imkoneu, that you have to calculate properly with the person who purchased him. Yidakdeik imkoneu, it has to be done in a manner of exactitude. And therefore, there's a burden on both parties to ensure that a proper price is paid in order to free this Eved Ivri if they buy him out before the Yovel. On the other hand, the Balei HaTosafot over here, as well as many of the other Rishonim, believe that the word Yiglom over here is not like what Rashi suggests, which means kefel or a doubling of the price, but rather Yiglom alav sheet et haKnani, meaning that he shouldn't try to cheat the Knani, b'tein lo pachot mimash natan lo, and give him less than he really deserves. And he brings from the Parasha Oruch that says a similar thing, that Giglom or Gelem means a mistake. The Rashba views it as Chomer Gelem, which means raw material or unformed material. Don't try to just give him a price that has no basis in the proper value of the individual. And what all these Rishonim are saying is, you can't use the court system to free this Eved Ivri inappropriately, but you also can't do it through cheating the guy out of the proper price that he's supposed to receive. You have to do it by the letter of the law, and you have to calculate how many years are left until the Yovel from the time that he bought him, the years that already expired, and now what is left to pay him, and you have to give him the fair value of the Eved Ivri. So you see that there is a requirement not to be gozel et haKnani. I'm Rav Yosef. Lokasha, that's not a problem. Hab Knani, hab ger toshav. Depends what type of non-Jew that we're speaking about here. Are we speaking about a Knani? Gezla Knani is mutar. Are you talking about a ger toshav? Rashi's definition of a ger toshav is here, is eno aved avodah zarah, does not worship avodah zarah, but he's ochel nevelot. There are other definitions by the Rishonim as to whether he needs to keep the Shiva mitzvah b'nei Noach, only some of the Shiva mitzvah b'nei Noach. But he's clearly not Jewish, but he lives in the land of Israel as a ger toshav, and therefore he has rights, or we treat him in a different manner because he's accepted the Shiva Mitzvah B'nei Noach, or he's accepted not to worship Avodah Zarah, and therefore you cannot steal from him. So Amalei Abaye says to his Rebbe, Rav Yosef, Vatar Vayu Gavei Hadodik Divei, Right? You can't say that that's the case because in those parshiot in Vayikra, over there it talks about a downfall of an individual who gets involved in Averot, starting from the selling of Perot Shvi'it, the bad things that will happen to him, until he finally has to sell himself. The final stages there is not only does he have to sell himself as an Eved Ivri to another Jew, but he'll also have to sell himself to a non-Jew. Not only to a non-Jew, but even to Avodah Zarah, or to the Komrei Avodah Zarah. So there in the Parshiyah, as we're going to darsh in a second, it makes no distinction between a Ger Toshav and a Knani. And therefore the Parshiyah applies to all of them equally. And that's what he says here. Lo lecha, ela leger. David Ivri here, this individual will not be sold as a slave to you, but rather to the Ger Toshav. Shenemar leger. Below the Ger Tzedek, we're not talking about a righteous convert over here. Ela the Goder Toshav. Shenemar leger Toshav. Because it specifies the type of Ger that we're speaking about over there. Mishpachat Ger. When it says Mishpachat Ger in the Parshiyah there, it means not only to the Ger Toshav, but Ezeh Oved Kochavim. That is to someone who is an idol worshiper. Kshomer, O the Eker. That's someone who sold to Avodah Zarah itself, or to the priests of Avodah Zarah, meaning that he's made to work on behalf of the Avodah Zarah. So you see in the definition from the Midrashei Halakha over there, that those parshiyot are not only speaking about a Ger Toshav, they're even speaking about a Knani. And if the din of Rabbi Akiva applies to whoever is found in that parsha, that means that you can't steal from whomever is found in that parsha. And that would include both a Ger Toshav, as well as an Knani, and therefore you can't make this distinction that Rav Yosef made. El Amarov Alokasha Kan Bigzelo Kan Bhavkat Halvato. Here it comes down to a big distinction that has major nafkamino de Alocha, which is that Rava says that Gezel, outright theft, is not allowed. Kan Bhavkat Halvato. The simplest understanding of this is to not pay back loans that he owes, meaning that he slips out of having to pay obligations that he has, but not outright theft from the individual. Amar le Abaye, Eved Ivri, Hafkat Havotohu. Wait a minute, Abaye says, how can you make that distinction? Because of the case of Eved Ivri, is also Hafkat Havotohu. The way that an Eved Ivri works is that he sells the leasehold in his work to the individual. Basically, he is mortgaging forward his Masei Yadayim, and the individual pays a price for that. So the person is buying his Masei Yadayim, and he basically owes the person who purchased him his Masei Yadayim. So therefore, if he does not carry out, does not follow through on making the person whole with that leasehold, then it's not outright theft. It's just Hafkat Havato. He owes him that money. He owes him that work. And if he doesn't do it, it's Hafkat Havato. So again, Rava, how can you make such a distinction that the difference is between outright gezel, where that is not permitted, versus hafkat havato, if the case of Eved Ivri itself is a case of hafkat havato? The Gemara says, Rava the Tamei, Rava's the Shitato, Damar Rava, Eved Ivri gufo kanui. When it comes to an Eved Ivri, he doesn't just sell his Masei Yadayim, but Rava believes that an Eved Ivri, similar to an Eved Knani, sells himself into servitude completely, and that the owner of the Eved Ivri owns him completely, owns his goof, and not just his Masei Yadayim, meaning that he owns him as physical property. Now, what's interesting here is that that's only true with regards to a Jew that buys an Eved Ivri. Is the din such that gufo kanui, though? It is not necessarily true by a Knani that buys the Jew. Nevertheless, what's indicated through Rava is that the ownership in an Eved Ivri is not simply the Masei Yadayim. There is a deeper form of ownership that exists in this situation, and therefore it will be more similar to Gezel than it will be to Hafkat Halvato. So what is clear from this Gemara is that Gezel HaKnani is not Mutar. And that is reinforced here by the statement of Amar Rabbi Bibi Bar Gido, Amar Rabbi Shimon Chasida, Gezel Knani Asur. Outright theft from a Knani is absolutely legal, and one may not do such. Avedato Mutarit. On the other hand, if you find his Aveda, then you can keep the lost item from that individual. Gzelo Asur, theft from him is Asur. Dam Ravuna, Menayin the Gezel HaKnani Shu Asur. How do we know that stealing or theft from a Knani is Asur? Shnemar V'chaltet Kolamim, Asher Hashem Lokecha Notein Lecha. That you will eat or consume the booty, the spoils of war from all those nations that you captured. Zman Shem Surim B'Yadecha. when you capture them, when it's under the rules of war, where the winner of the war or the person who conquers takes all the spoils of war, then you are permitted to take their items. But not in a case where that's not the situation. In a case where you're living civilly amongst other individuals, you have no right to take their possessions or to steal their possessions. And so therefore there's a restriction against Gezel HaKnani. So now we already have two sources for the fact that Gezel HaKnani is absolutely asur. On the other hand, when it comes to an Aveda, Aveda Tomuteret, the fact that it's Aveda is permitted, is because Amarav Kamar Baguri Amarav, Minayin Aveda Tog, the Knani Shimuteret, if you find an Aveda of a Knani that you mutar to keep it, Shnemar, the Chol Avedat Achicha, that it says that the requirement of a Shavat Aveda in the Torah is associated with Avedat Achicha, with your brother's Aveda, the Achicha Ata Machzir, that you have to return it to your fellow brother, V'yata makzir, the Knani, but you don't have to return it to the Knani. And again, here you have the qualification of the Shita Mekubetza that brings the Me'iri. You can see that broad on the side here. Shnu agim hefker b'kinyonei achirim, but they don't respect ownership. They don't respect the rules of law. Or on the other side, you can see sheish gam lo kamocha nimusim u'mishpatim tzadikim dvarim shemen adam lechaviro. If there is civil law between individuals, then there is a requirement to return it. And so once again here, the view of the Me'iri is that Achicha is not limited to Jews, but Achicha means anybody who keeps civil law and has respect for ownership between different parties. And the Knani over here represents people that are not under that societal influence, are not in cultures that give respect to that. And therefore the difference has nothing to do with a religious difference. It has to do with a societal difference between parties. On the other hand, most read this Gemara at face value. Now here, with regards to Aveda, it's much easier to understand. Aveda, when somebody loses something, the returning of a lost item is something that is, we'll call it lifni mishurat adin. It's beyond the letter of the law. Usually we say, or the famous expression, finders keepers. And so, therefore, when we have a requirement of Hashavat Aveda, is when someone is a part of the club. It's a similar idea to rebate with the charging of interest, where that you have to give interest-free loans. The Torah requires that only for people who are achicha, who are in the club, people who are similar in nature to you and believe in the same system of faith as you. And since they do believe in that, we give them a special credit. It's like being a member of any other society or any other group of individuals where the individuals do things for each other. Some of those items are we don't charge interest for loans. We return Avedot. When we find things that are lost, we return them to each other. So that's a agreement between the parties that are a party to this club or this religious belief. But that doesn't apply to people outside of it. And therefore, it's not about a bias. It's not about discrimination in any way. It's just those people aren't part of the club, so they don't get the benefits that come as being a member of the club. On the other hand, you could view this as a similar distinction to what Rava said before, which is the difference between outright gezel versus hafkat halvato, which is the non-payment of money's owed or non-payment of an object that's owed. You could look at this also as in that viewpoint, although I don't think the Gemara does, which is that we don't permit active gezel, but we do permit you to not return the item, which is not outright gezel, but it's something where you're withholding that which belongs to another individual. I think here the Gemara doesn't think that there's an obligation to return the Aveda. The obligation only applies to people who are Achicha. Now, the Shita Mekubetz, as we saw here, expands the definition of Achicha to include more than people that are simply in the same religious belief as you. So the Gemara now questions that and says, Ve'ema hani mile hechid de lo ati liyode. Maybe that's only true if it didn't come into his possession. De lo mechayiv la dure batra. Then he doesn't have to go chase him down, whether it's to pick up the Aveda and go find him and get it back to the original owner. Or, if the owner doesn't show up, you don't have to give it back to him. But maybe if he came into your possession, or you know the owner, maybe there would be an obligation to return it. Amaravina umitza'ata. The case of Hashavat Aveda in the Torah is a case where you found it. Da'ate yade mashmo. Sounds like it's in your possession. You have the Aveda, and despite the fact it's qualified by the word Achicha, which tells you that it only applies to Jews and not to non-Jews. Over here, I always quote the very famous Smag, the Smag in Mitzvah Ayin Dalid, when discussing the issue of Hashavat Aveda, quotes our Gemara over here with regards to the Ptur of Achicha. And as we're going to see in the Gemara coming up, an overarching theme here is that it has to be done in a manner that doesn't create any Chilul Hashem. And that will be an overarching theme here, that if any of these decisions cause Chilul Hashem, then it's not permitted at all. But what the Smag says is, if we are supposed to be the light unto the nations, an Or LaGoyim, and if we, when Mashiach comes, he's going to be to redeem our people, and he's going to take us up to Yerushalayim, and then everybody's going to look and see these are the people of God, then we have to act in a manner so that when Mashiach shows up, that the people look at us and say, wow, these are honest, upstanding, wonderful people, and it makes sense. I understand why Hashem has picked them as his people, why Mashiach has come to take them. On the other hand, if we act in ways that, yes, under the letter of the law might be permitted, but are not straightforward or not honest in the nature, then how are we going to be viewed by other people? We don't want the other nations to view us in a manner that says, oh, that's a Jew. And the definition that's brought in the dictionary, the unfortunate definition of the verb to Jew or to steal or not be honest or be conniving in a manner, we don't want that associated with ourselves. And therefore, the Smag says it's important that the way that we act, both towards our own people, but the way we act towards other nations and other peoples, should represent an honesty and integrity that will bring other people to understand what it means to be a Jew, and also why the Jews are chosen as the people of God, because they act like the people of God. It's an unbelievable Smag in Siman Ayin Dalet, and is definitely worth reading just to remind ourselves of this important fact. Now the Gemara talks about the overarching thesis of all of this, which is Tanya Reb Pichas ben Yair Omer, Makom Sheyesh Chilul Hashem, when it comes to Chilul Hashem, Afilu Avedato Asur. Then even keeping his Avedas Asur, Hafkat Havato would be Asur. All of these issues would be Asur. When it comes to issues of Chilul Hashem, Amar Shmuel, Ta'uto Muteret. But if there is a mistake, it is, again, mutar to overlook the mistake and not go and correct the situation and keep the wrongfully gotten monies in that case. Gyadishmuel. And the Gemara brings an example of a case like that. Zavin Mikuti, who's purchasing from Mikuti Lakna de Dahava, seems like a bar of gold or some sort of gold item. Bimar de Parzala, at a price of iron or regular metal, probably the word should be something that means nechoshet, means copper over here. That's the way Rashi explains it. Copper and gold look similar. And so Shmuel assumed or knew that it was gold, and the individual was selling it like it was copper. And Shmuel didn't inform him of that fact. Bedalad zuze. He bought it for 4 zuz, meaning that he was buying it at the price of copper and not at the price of gold. But he didn't bother to correct the individual because in that situation, it looks like it's an honest mistake. Shmuel is buying it. The guy thinks he's selling copper. Shmuel can say, well, you told me it was copper. I was buying copper, so I give you a price of copper. And then he swallowed up an extra zuz. Rashi over here views this as another attempt at ta'ut, which is not only did he not tell him it was gold, even though he was buying it at a copper price, but also in that price, instead of giving him the 4 zuz, he gave him 3, as if it was 4, like he made a mistake. We'll see examples of that in the upcoming cases. That's probably what drives Rashi that way. But all the other Rishonim disagree with Rashi and explain it the other way around, which is that Ve'ivla Le'zuzah, he actually paid him a little more so that he gave him extra money so that he felt good about selling him this Nechoshet. He felt like Shmuel probably was making a mistake and overpaying for the Nechoshet. So Shmuel paid him a little extra so this guy would just be happy and wouldn't want to question the case at all. And even though he was getting gold, which had significantly more value, Shmuel gave him more money so that he felt good about selling his nechoshet. So again, all of this can be viewed in the context of an honest mistake, and therefore won't lead to a chilul Hashem, even if someone discovers the problem in the situation. Which is similar to a case like this, which is of a kahana. Zavan mikute mea v'esrim chavito. He bought from a kuti 120 barrels, b'mea, with 100 zuz. V'ivle echad zuzah. And then he swallowed up 1 zuz. So over here, the explanation, according to Rashi, is that he paid him less than the 100 that was supposed to be there. He only gave him 99, or he gave him 98. but he made it look like an honest mistake. For the other mefarshim, he added on a little more money, meaning that even though he was buying 120 barrels and he probably should have paid 120 to him, instead he was paying 100, but he put a little extra in there so that the individual would feel good because he feels like he's getting a better price than he had expected. On the other hand, Rav Kahana really believes that he's getting the upper hand here because he's buying 120 barrels instead of 100 for the 100 or a little more than 100 zuz that he is paying. And said, Amarlay, and he says to him, Chazid Allah Kasamichna. So Rashi brings here two possibilities about this language. One is that Rav Kahana said to him, listen, I'm counting on you. I'm handing you the money. You should count the money to ensure that it's correct, and I'm relying on you. And if the individual doesn't choose to count the money and there's a mistake in the money, that's his problem. Or Rashi brings an alternative lashon, which says just the opposite, which is that the guy says, look, I'm relying on you. I assume that whatever's in there is the right amount. And again, this language or this idea allows for the possibility that if there is any mistake in the pricing or that which happened, it can all be attributed to quote-unquote a mistake, and there won't be any chilul Hashem from it. Ravina Zavin Dikla Hu Vikuti Litzalcha. So he and Ikuti, in a partnership, bought a palm tree that was going to be split, and the wood was going to be then divided between them for logs of wood for firewood. Amalei Lashamei Kadam V'Aitam Yikoro. You should go there first and take from the bottom of the trunk of the tree. Dikuti Minyono Yodo. The Kuti knows how many logs of wood that there are, so we're not going to cheat in terms of dividing up the number of logs, because he knows he is supposed to get so many, and I'm supposed to get so many. But the size of the logs, which is not as something as important or that people focus on, we may as well go get the bigger logs. So we'll take the bigger logs, give him the smaller logs. He'll think he gets the right number. We'll say we get the same number. And then if he realizes afterwards, wait, you took all the bigger logs, he'll say, oh, that was just a mistake. We were just talking from one side and the other side. So again, these are differences in the transaction that can come up that can be attributed to, quote unquote, a mistake. And therefore, even if they're done intentionally, they won't result in a chilul Hashem. Ravashi have a ka'azil be'orcha. Ravashi was going down the way. Chaza shivsha d'gufna be'pardesa. He saw these branches of the vines from the vineyard. And it seems here that they were hanging over into the Rishut Arabim. And hanging from there were bunches of grapes that were out in the Rishut HaRabim beyond the borders of the vineyard. Amalei Lashamei, he turned to his servant and said to him, Zil Chazi, go see about this field. Ita kuti ninhu, if it belongs to a kuti in a Jew, aiti, then give it to me. Go and pick it and take it from me. Ita Yisrael ninhu, lo aiti li. If it doesn't belong to a kuti, but rather to Israel, don't bring it from me. Shama kuti davayoti v'pardesa. The Kuti that was sitting in the vineyard overheard this conversation between Rav Ashi and his servant. Amalei de Kuti Shari, is that the case that that of a Kuti is permitted? Meaning that, why is there a difference? To steal from a Kuti is okay, but from a Jew is not okay. Why are you making such a distinction? So Amalei, Kuti Shakil Demei, a Kuti will take money for it. Yisrael lo Shakil Demei, but Yisrael will not take money for it. Now, from the context of the Gemara, and the way that most of the Rishonim explain it over here, and you can see that in the Tosfot over here, the Rav Ashi was actually being honest with him and telling him that's exactly the distinction. I don't want to take gifts from anyone. I am a big gadol ador. If it's a field of Israel, he's not going to accept payment for it either because, in general, they are mochel and these types of items, or because they know it's me, Rav Ashi, and therefore they want to give it to me as a gift. Therefore, if it's an Israel's property, I don't want to take it because they're not going to accept payment for it. If it's a Kuti's property, then I know he will accept payment for it, and then I'm willing to take it, because then I can pay him for it. So Rav Ashi was actually telling the truth, and the distinction he was making was a distinction that in reality made sense, which is that he wanted to pay for it, and therefore he only wanted to take it from individuals who would be willing to accept payment, and that would be a Kuti versus Israel. But not that Rav Ashi was trying to come up with an excuse after the fact or mislead this Kuti as to why he made such a distinction. On the other hand, you could read the Gemara, and the fact that Tosafot rejects it tells you that there were others that read it otherwise, which is that Rav Ashi was just making up a distinction here in order to get out of the problem of Chilul Hashem. And therefore, he gave an explanation which is not necessarily true lahalacha, because he felt halachically that if it was a Jew's property, it would be improper to steal. Whereas if it was a Goy's property, he'd be permitted to take it. Again, not because there it's not gezel or outright gezel, because it's hanging over into the Shut Rabim, and there are people that would think possibly that that's okay, or was a mistake, that he didn't realize it belonged to the vineyard, and that there are ways to make it, that it wouldn't be a Chilul Hashem, and therefore he felt it was okay to take from the Kuti, but that would not be permitted when it comes to Yisrael. His explanation was just a way to get out of the problem after the fact, once the person realized he was making such a distinction that could lead to a Chilul Hashem. So again, here, just to wrap up, in terms of this sugya about the Gezel Ager, even in instances where it's permitted, like for instance, not returning the Aveda, or Hafkat Halvato, there is an overarching requirement that there be no Chilul Hashem. And therefore, almost all the Rishonim and the Poskei Halacha believe that when it comes to Aveda, because of Eva, Mishum Eva, or because of the Kiddush Hashem that could come about from this, that there is a value in returning these items. The same would be true with Ta'ut, with the mistake. Whether it's a mistake made, and it can be honestly viewed as an honest mistake and not a Chilul Hashem, the person doesn't have an obligation to return it. But if the person returns it and through that generates a Kiddush Hashem, how much greater is that? How much wonderful is that that they can generate a Kiddush Hashem along the lines of what the Smag says? Because that gives a shame tov to these individuals, to Jews, and to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And therefore, there's a value in creating such a Kiddush Hashem when a person notes the mistake and is honest and has tremendous integrity in their dealings with other individuals. And the same is true with Hafkat Halvato, which is the withholding of payment, not active theft, but withholding of payment, which again would be permitted when it comes to Gezel of a Kna'ani, but that would only be true in a case where it won't generate a Chilul Hashem. And we know now that when people are caught in terms of tax evasion, which might fall under the rubric of Hafkat Halvato, although many Rishonim feel that it falls under Dina de Malchut de Dina, and therefore there's no permission to escape from that taxation because it's rightful taxation, and therefore there's no ability to walk away from it. There's no permission to walk away from it. But even if you believe that there is some permission because of Hafkat Halvato, then you have to still consider the issues of Chilul Hashem, and that if an individual like this is caught tax evading, we know that they'll be in the front page of the newspaper, and the tremendous Chilul Hashem that is created. And therefore, a person has to think ahead that tax evasion is not only going to be Hafkat Havato, and maybe is mutter under the halacha. They have to think about the possible ramifications of the Chilul Hashem that could be created if they are caught tax evading, and therefore it's not worth it. Or it would be completely improper, because we know that if they get caught, it will be a tremendous Chilul Hashem, especially if it's dealing with religious institutions or people who are clearly religious. All these things will lead to a tremendous Chilul Hashem, and therefore should not be even in the inkling of being permitted, or a person shouldn't think that it's okay. Now, again, to be aggressive in their understanding of the tax law, or to do things that are tax avoidance measures, which again can be acceptable under the law, then there could be a case with the taxing authorities. But in all of those cases, we're talking about justified stances where the person's not trying to necessarily tax evade, but there is a disagreement about the understanding or the meaning of the laws. In those cases, there might be room to do it, or even take a very aggressive stance, because over there, it won't generate necessarily a Chilul Hashem, because there's an explanation for why you did this or how you went about doing this. But the key element that won't come about is a Chilul Hashem. And so therefore, people have to be extremely careful in these situations. And I always, again, I love what the Smag says, is that we want to be representatives of HaKadosh Baruch Hu and Or LaGoyim. And therefore, we should always think in terms of what's the greatest Kiddush Hashem that we can do and how we can represent Hashem by being honest and having tremendous integrity with other people. Now, Gufa, Mar says, Amar Shmuel, Dina de Machuta Dina, that Shmuel says the fact that the laws of the land govern, Amarova Teda, how do we know that this is the case? The Katle Dikle, because the government comes into our property, cuts down our palm trees, Vigashre Gishre, and then they build bridges with our palm trees, Vavrina Nalayu, and then we traverse those bridges and we use those bridges and we don't see that they're a Surim. So Amar Abaye, so Abaye says, maybe the reason that we're allowed to cross these bridges is because the owners have Yeush, they give up hope of getting them back. So now you have Yeush, and possibly Shinoi Rishut, or shinoi maase. And if that's the case, the reason we can go on them is not because it's not theft, not because they're justified in taking them, but there's enough that's happened here that they're no longer stolen materials, and that's why we can cross these bridges. Samalei, ilo dina de machuta dina, it wasn't for the fact that this was the law of the land, and the law of the land governed, heichem yaishe, then why would they give up hope of getting them back? Rashi says, klomar, mi avi yeush, ha yeush kadi havi. What type of yeush is this? Even if they do have yeush, the way Rashi explains it is, the yeush would not suffice, because it's yeush alone. They don't do a shinui maiseh. They don't change the logs. We saw that earlier in the Masechta that the palm trees, well, even if it's cut up into different pieces, is still considered under the original name, and so there is no shinui maiseh. And there's no shinui reshut because they're put out in the public domain. Someone hasn't taken possession of them. And so Rashi says that even if you believe that there is yeush over here, that would not suffice if it was not for dina de machuta dina. On the other hand, Tosafot reads it more simply, like the Gemara is saying over here, that if you believe that dina machuta dina is not the law of the land, then hayalahem lidvo bedinit kol adam ovrim alehem. Then these individuals should go stand by the bridges and ask people to pay a toll to cross the bridge because their trees were used to build this bridge. And the fact that they don't go over there shows you that they've given up hope of getting it back because what was taken from them was rightfully taken them under the law. And that's why they have yeush over here, because the law states that this is the case. Gemara says, "V'aloka avde k'da amar malko." Wait a minute. The representatives of the king who come along and cut down these trees by the decree of the king to build the roads, they don't follow the instructions of the king. Malka marzilu katlu mikol bage. The king goes and says, take evenly or equally from all the people in this area. Each of them should have to contribute palm trees. Vinu azu b'katlu mechad baga. And these individuals go, and they go into one location and just cut down all the trees in that location. They don't spread out the toll or the tax between all the people in the area. They simply go to one area and they just cut all the trees down. Where it says, Shlucha de Malka Kemalka. First of all, the representatives of the king are like the king. And therefore, if they decide they want to take it from one area, that's their business. Velo Tarach, then they don't want to bother. Meaning that if they want to take all the trees from here, it's just much easier for them to cut all the wood one here, build the bridge from there, instead of going around and having to collect the wood from everyone else. They don't want that burden. Vinu afsida nafshayu. And the people who had all the trees taken from their bigah, they actually caused the loss to themselves. They should have gone around and collected from all the people in the surrounding area and say, look, they took the palm trees from us. All of us were really in this. Out of convenience, they took from our field. But now you guys all owe us money in order to use the bridge. And then they could collect their money back. So it's really the burden is being shifted from the king to collect the toll or the taxes to the individuals who they take the trees from. But those people that the trees were taken from do have a right to collect from others who are beneficiaries of the bridge and should have been those that pay taxes. So Amarova, Mande Mishtakach Bebe Dori, Paramato de Malko. The one who was found in the threshing floor, he pays the tax to the king. So there were different types of taxes. We know there were poll taxes, land taxes, but there were also things like a harvest tax, which is that once you harvest the field, a certain percentage of the output of the field was given to the government. So over here, if you have a bunch of partners that were in the threshing floor, three or four partners, then they all split up their grain. Three of them went home already, and the fourth one was still picking up his stuff, and all of a sudden the government's representative shows up, the tax collector shows up and says, well, what was the production on this field? It was four times the amount. You pay taxes for all of the people here. Because you're the only one that I can find here now. You have to pay for everybody that's there. What the Gemara says is that's a justified position to take because he is a partner. And therefore, first of all, it's not theft because you can't take from one partner on behalf of all the partners. And number two is that individual has recourse to go back to the other partners. And that's what the Gemara says. That's a case when they are partners. So if the tax collector here is a Jewish tax collector, then he is justified in taking. It's not called theft when he takes it from that individual. So both he is justified in taking it, and the individual pays it, has recourse to the other partners. On the other hand, Avalarisa Arusutehu de Kamofik. On the other hand, if he's a sharecropper, that is not the case. If he's a sharecropper, he does not represent the owner of the land. And therefore, if the Jewish tax collector takes from him for the whole land, that's theft, because it's not the sharecropper's obligation or right to give the payment for the land. and he has to go after the owner of the land, not after the sharecropper. And number two is that the sharecropper pays it, he has no recourse against the owner because he shouldn't have paid for it. It wasn't his obligation or right to pay for it. Amar Rava, and Rava says also, Barmata, a Barmata miavet, that if an individual doesn't pay his poll tax or tax to the government, the government can take a collateral from his friend or force his friend to pay for him. Meaning that the obligation devolves on the city as a whole or to all the members of the city. If they're unable to collect from one member, they're going to go and take it from another member. And again, that's not called stealing. That's not called theft, because that's the nature of the way the tax works. That individual who was taken from now has recourse against the individuals that didn't pay the tax, as well as the fact that the individual who did collect the tax is not considered to be stealing, because this is the way it works. That's only when we're talking about the land tax or the poll tax for that year, or the harvest tax and the poll tax for that year. Avashata de Khalif, if he's collecting for last year's, if he's collecting for last year, that's already considered to be theft, because the king was already satisfied. He got paid whatever it was for last year, and if they didn't manage to collect last year, or he didn't get from this individual last year, he doesn't have a right now to come and ask him and to make him pay those back taxes, because whatever the king accepted, he was happy with, and therefore the situation is done. And once the situation is done, we don't go back and try to reopen the case. Basically, the statute of limitations has gone. And if he tries to collect taxes now, that is considered to be theft. V'amarova, hane de dairi dari, betocha tchum, those individuals who provide fertilizing services within the tchum, meaning that they are close to the city, proximate to the city, asur likach mehem, one may not purchase from them. The way Rashi explains it is that you can't purchase animals from them, because the animals of the people of the city kind of join their flocks. And since they join their flocks, there might be animals that don't belong to them. If you purchase an animal, it might come from someone from the city who they basically absconded with their animal because they wandered out and joined their herd. On the other hand, there are others who suggest that you may not buy the fertilizer from them because the fertilizer is mixed not only with the fertilizer that they are producing, but that which belongs to the individuals of the city who also had their animals, and then they stole that fertilizer or that dung from the people of the city. So in a case where it's proximate to the city, the way that they did this is either that they had an area or corralled area where their animals produced all the dung, and then they sold the fertilizer from that area, or you hired them to bring in their animals, and then they produced the dung in your field, and that's how they fertilized your field. Either way, if it's proximate to the city, there's a problem of possible theft here, and therefore you can't transact with them. My time off. And the reason being, Mishum da arva chiyuta damata behadayu. The animals of the city get mixed up with them. Either according to Rashi, therefore you can't buy the animals from them, or for others, you can't buy the fertilizer from them. Chutz l'tchum, where if they're way out, outside the area that is the normal city limits, mutar likach lehem, there you can buy from them, because again, they don't get mixed up. The animals of the city don't go out that far. The animals of the city don't produce fertilizer out where they are, and therefore it's mutar to buy from them. Amravina, imayu balim radfim achreim afilu chutz l'tchum asur. On the other hand, if the owners of an animal, according to Rashi, or the owners of the fertilizer, according to the other Rishonim, were chasing after them, going out chutz l'tchum and saying, it's mine, it's mine, it's mine, then even though they're outside of the tchum, if someone is declaring or making it clear that they have taken something that belongs to him, then you can't purchase from them, because there's a possibility that there's gezel mixed up in that which they are selling to you. Machriz Rava, v'item Rav Huna, the salkin le'ela, or the nachtin le'tata, those that go up, and those that come down, seems to be those that travel up to Eretz Yisrael, and those that descend from Eretz Yisrael to Bavel. Hai bar Yisrael, diyada sa'aduta le'kuti, a Jew who knows testimony for a kuti, velo tavu mine, and here is a question in the Girsa, the Gra takes out this line in the Girsa, but they did not ask him to come be a witness in the case. But also, asidle bedine de kute al Israel chavre, and he goes voluntarily and testifies against his fellow Jew in the case. Mishamtinle, we put him into shamta, we excommunicate him. So now, according to the Girsa that we have in the Gemara, it's because they didn't ask him to come testify; he voluntarily went in and testified. The way that the Gra writes it and eliminates lo tavu mine is the mere fact that he went to testify in the case is problematic. My time, what's the problem over here? Dinu mafki mamona puma dechad, that they take out money based on a single aid. And this goes against the dinim of the Torah, that they rely on a single witness rather than two witnesses for the extraction of money. And so by your going and testifying in this case, you're allowing them now to take money from this Yisrael inappropriately or improperly, al pi dinei Torah. Velo amran el echad. That's only true if you are a single witness. Aval betray, if there are two witnesses, lo, then it's not a problem, because then they are following the dinei Torah. And if you have two witnesses, then you're permitted to testify in the case. We're not talking about being dishonest over here. We're not trying to cheat people out. We just want to have it go up here, the halachot of the Torah. And again, lo amran ela bedine de megista. It's only true when we're talking about courts that are set up in the villages. We'll call them small courts or vigilante courts, courts that don't necessarily abide by any rule of law. And that's where we will not want you to testify because, first of all, they don't follow the general halachot of the Torah. And also, they pervert justice. So we don't want you testifying in cases that involve these court systems. When you're talking about the major courts of the government, inunami, they also, achad mumta shadule. They, with one witness, only allow the individual or force the individual to take a shvuah, to counteract the aid, like the din Torah. And therefore, you can testify even as a single aid in those cases, because that doesn't go against the din Torah. They will not extract money based on that eid achad. They only force a shvuah, which is the din Torah. And therefore, it would be permitted to testify in such a case, and we wouldn't put you bishamta. Now, Tosfot over here makes an interesting point. Didn't we just say before in the Gemara that hafkat havato is mutar? And therefore, maybe the Jew in this case could make a denial, and that denial would be permitted under the halacha, and he would get away with not paying money. Your testimony now changes the case and forces him to pay money. So what Tosfot says is, even though it's not nice, and you shouldn't do it, because now you're going to obligate the individual, nevertheless, we're not going to put you into shamta, we're not going to put you into excommunication for that, because of the fact that you caused him to pay money that he otherwise owed. Since he owed the money, really, you're causing him to pay it, is not necessarily a loss that we're going to put you or excommunicate you for. Even though he had the ability to deny it and do hafkat havato, that's not necessarily a right that will put the other individual into shamta for. But it's interesting because Tosfot clearly sees in that dynamic that it's okay to do hafkat havato and that we would promote such an idea even if it requires lying, as long as there's no chilul Hashem involved in it. Amar Rav Ashi, ki avina bei Rav Huna, or the alternate girsa is Rav Kahana, because we saw that earlier that Rav Ashi was at the Beit Midrash, or the court of Rav Kahana. Yibaylan adam chashuv, desamchi alei kebeit rei. If you have an important individual who they rely on like two individuals, meaning that he has such nemanut, or his stature gives him believability like two edim, mafki mamona apune, velo yibayad alei lusude, since they are going to extract money based on his testimony, therefore he should not go and testify. Odilma kevin d'adam chashuvu lo matzi mishtamet lehu. Or since he's an important individual, he's not going to be able to slip away and get out of having to testify in court. Umatzi lasude, and therefore he has to testify or should testify. Teiko, we leave that as being an unresolved issue. Amar Rav Ashi, hi Bar Yisrael, the zaven le'ara aved kochavim are metzra de Bar Yisrael. Chavre, this Jew who sold his property to a non-Jew that is bordering or is adjacent to another Jew's land, mishamtinan land, we put him into shamta. My time, what's the reason? In a mishum dina de bar metzra, if we say because of the dina bar metzra, which is a din we'll bump into in the Gemara in Baba Batra, which is that when it comes to adjacent properties, the person that's living nearby has a first right of refusal, which is that if you sell it, the neighboring landowner has the right to match that price and take it because of a matter of convenience. He already owns the land there. He can get scale. It makes a lot of sense for him to buy it. If you're going to garner the same price anyway, then why not sell it to him and have him benefit from it versus selling it to a third party who doesn't get that type of benefit? And therefore, he has a first right of refusal. If you say the reason we put him into shamta is because he didn't offer the neighbor that first right of refusal, v'amamar, zavin me'akum v'zavin le'akum, someone who purchases from a non-Jew or sells to a non-Jew, leka mishum din de bar metzra. There is no din of bar metzra, of a first right of refusal of neighboring lands in that case. Ela de amri le, but the reason that the Jew here can blame his fellow Jew for selling the adjacent land to the non-Jew is because he can say to him, arvait li arya mitzre, you just planted a crouching lion at the edge of my field. And therefore, mishamtinan le, we put him to shamta, we excommunicate him, adekabel le, kom unsa de'ate machmete, until he takes responsibility for any damage or problems that arise from selling this to the non-Jewish neighbor. Now, the Balei Tosafot, the Rabbeinu Tam over here, qualifies that and says that's only in a case where the neighboring Jew was willing to pay the same price as the Ovid Kulchavim. So even though there's no din of Bar Metzra in that case because there's a non-Jew involved in the transaction, nevertheless, since the Jew was willing to pay the same price, and now this other Jew who sold it to the Goy made it a difficult situation for the Jew that's living adjacent, that's why we make him responsible over there, and that's why he put him to Shamta. But if he pays a price that's far in excess of what the adjacent property owner was willing to pay, then in that situation, we do not put him into Shamta, and we do not force him to take responsibility, because why shouldn't he garner the highest price there? And it's not his fault that the other buyer wasn't willing to pay up for it. Okay, we're going to stop here by the Mishnah on the top of Kuf Yud Daled Amud Aleph.